We'll get started in a couple more minutes. I'm Bill Densmore. I am working with Colin and the other folks who've organized the Citizen Journalism Track. I think several of you have already met me, but I'm affiliated with both the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri and also with the Media Giraffe Project at UMass Amherst. I'm not a PEC Access person, but I used to own weekly newspapers in Massachusetts, and one of the things we spent a lot of time doing is collaborating with our local PEG Access people, because they were fabulous at taking what we wanted to do, which was create community forums on important civic topics, and put them in an organized video and archive format. And so I've thought for many, many years that there was a natural synergy between what we do in the news business and what you do in the PEG Access business. One thing I want to remind you is that we're audio recording this session, as we have all of the sessions, so that we create a permanent archive of useful information for other people like you who can't make it. And also, Colin would like to just kind of summarize briefly what we've done in the other three sessions up until now, and then we'll carry on.
Okay, hi everybody. I'm Colin Ransmith from Cambridge Community Television, for those of you who haven't gotten a chance to talk with yet. So I just want to say, this is the last session of the citizen journalism portion of our track. And I don't know about you, but this has been an incredible conversation that I'm really excited that got started, and I hope to continue this conversation with all of you beyond this conference. There are ways to do that, we'll talk about that. But what I did want to say, I want to be very clear what's going to happen today, just so all of you know, and if you're not into that, you can get up and leave or whatever, is the last couple of sessions, I think we've had a really good discussion on some of the nuts and bolts, how to get started with the citizen journalism program. I think you've seen a lot of case studies that might be helpful for you in thinking about starting your own program in your communities and how it relates to the mission of your Access Center. This session, as a final session, we're going to kind of go big picture. We're going to kind of blow it up and out, and talk about how public policy might help us in the future, those of us in Access, those of us who are doing other things related to this concentration on citizen journalism, and how our projects can serve the information needs of communities and democracy, which you might see the reports on your chairs. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough for everybody, so if you could share, that would be great. And Bill will probably go more into the details, but just wanted to give you a preview there. And I'll turn it back over to you.
Great.
Thanks.
One thing to remind you about is that we have a wiki at peg.rchannels.org, which includes information about each of the sessions, and this is the wiki page for this session. And the other thing I want to make sure you know about is that the Knight Commission report that Colin just mentioned is there's all kinds of details about it and follow-up about the sort of next steps on the Knight Commission report at knightcom.org. The effort that's underway now with a grant that the Knight Commission gave to Aspen Institute is to figure out how to translate the recommendations of the Knight Commission on information needs of communities into real actions on the ground. And so if you bookmark that website and come back to it periodically, I think you'll begin to see things happening around the country that are relevant to what you're trying to do with citizen journalism locally. So we've got three people here who represent, I think, different aspects of the challenge. One, and Laurie, I know that you don't want to be the proxy for everybody in this room here, but Laurie's the proxy for the practitioner, for the person who's on the ground really pioneering the connection between PEG Access and citizen journalism. And then we have with us also from the Open Technology Initiative of the New America Foundation, Jim Lucy, who will talk second. And then Candace Clement from freepress.net. And I note that you can keep in touch with Candace pretty regularly, because she's the voice, the audio voice on Media Minutes, which is a web podcast of interesting, important tidbits in information policy that's produced weekly by Free Press, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
So rather than thinking of these three people as panelists, I'd like to think of them as co-participants in the discussion that we're going to be having. What I'd like them to do is frame their three areas, but I want you all to be thinking as they are talking about the what I've got up on the screen now, which is on page X1 of the Knight Commission report. The key objectives that the Knight Commission, after over a year of public meetings and meetings of the commission, and a detailed report which was written by a team which included Mike Fancher, they came up with these three core objectives. One, maximize the availability of relevant and credible information to all Americans in their communities. Two, strengthen the capacity of individuals to engage with information. And three, promote individual engagement with information and the public life of the community. So after we hear from our three sort of discussion leaders, what I hope we can have and can capture for both on tape and in notes to the screen is the ways in which you think your organization can help achieve those three objectives. The ways that you can do it, the ways in which you think you need help achieving those objectives. Mike Fancher is the retired executive editor of the Seattle Times. He's also the ethics chair of the American Society of News Editors. He was with me at the Reynolds Journalism Institute as a fellow in 2008-2009. He was one of the principal authors of this document. And he gave an interview a couple weeks ago to Len Witt, who runs the Center for Sustainable Journalism at Kennesaw State University outside of Atlanta. And I thought it was really interesting what Mike said. He said, have the community at the center of everything you do. Bring people into your thought process. Get the benefit of finding out more precisely what their news information needs are, and be in a real partnership with them. And for heaven's sake, take advantage of their intelligence, their knowledge of the community, and their ability to help you create better journalism. I think that would be a very important starting point. The reason why I'm reading that is because, to me, that's what my experience with PEG Access tells me you all do every day in a much more intimate way than actually legacy media has been used to over the last 20 or 30 years. Legacy media, from which I come, was so used to being in semi-fat city that they kind of got out of touch with the community. The community walks into your media centers every day, and you have to deal with them. I heard somebody earlier saying that you deal with the little, George, yesterday, last night, he said, look, we deal with the little people in the community, and they are what keep us going. So I think you're already, ironically, one step ahead of legacy media in terms of making the transition from what I call the gatekeepers of the past to the information valets of the future. So let me stop there and go to first to Lori and ask you, in the context that we're setting here, talk a little bit, if you would please, about what it's like on the ground.
I like that term, valet.
Okay.
I just have to say that. Good job, Bill. Okay, so yeah, I'm the proxy for the feet on the ground. And just in case you haven't worked in
the... Do you want the plug to cert, or do you want to just stand up and use this?
Actually, I'll just put it on that page for right now, because mostly going to talk, but...
I'll be happy to move it around if you want me to. Yeah.
I don't want to get into how we did the Rapidian. But the Rapidian is our citizen journalism platform that we launched last September. It is in response to the changing news and information needs of our community. And I think it would be helpful for this session maybe to talk a little bit about how we approached this. And there were really three things that we looked at. What do we know now? Who cares? And how do we organize to address those things? Basically, in our community, it's about 180,000 people in Grand Rapids itself. This is Grand Rapids, Michigan, not Minnesota, in case anybody wonders. We did, as many have, a shrinking traditional media scene. On the day that it was announced that we got a Knight grant, our daily paper went from four sections to two. We used to have 5 full-time medical reporters. Now we have about the equivalent of a 3/4 in our community, a community with massive building of new hospitals, cancer centers, a medical school, and we don't have any health reporters anymore. We are seeing many of the same struggles. We still have daily delivery, but we don't know how long that will last. We were also seeing trends partially reflected in social media of people being less willing to simply accept passivity in receipt of information. People want to engage with information and not just be sponges. Some of the other things is that neighborhoods. I mean, we are feet on the ground, and our neighborhoods feeling very misrepresented or unheard completely. And we do have an issue in Grand Rapids, and this was reflected in a number of other projects, of much diversity but much segregation of neighborhoods that rarely intersect and only know each other from the headlines. And with shrinking media, what they only get now is who got shot and whose house was broken into and whose baby was kidnapped or something. And that's not really a great way to promote people living in the same town to know each other as human beings. And that's a real issue, and people are increasingly angry about that. And then, of course, the nonprofit sector, used to sending out their press releases, et cetera, where, you know, their budgets are struggling, and they were getting less and less visibility through traditional media. So we knew these things. Then we looked at who were our partners. And we've been very fortunate in Grand Rapids as a community media center for many, many years to constantly be forging new partnerships and collaborations. One of our strongest partners is our community foundation. Our community foundation... Community Foundations was the target of the Particular Night initiative that was launched, and basically it was an offer to match dollar for dollar news and information projects in a community, and the partner was actually, with Night, was actually the Community Foundation. They called us and said, you know, so what do you think? We became the execution partner for this project, which basically meant Night gave our foundation money, our foundation matched it, and then they granted all of it to the media center to execute the vision. So then, you know, how did we say, okay, this is what we think we know in our community, these are some of the issues, there's less information available, growing frustration, and we're not effectively using information to deal with some of our systemic issues in our community, and less now than ever. So we basically took a number of approaches, and some of them have worked, most of them have worked very well, some of them not so well. But basically, we wanted to approach this from a position of ownership by the community. The community media center, our community media center, has a tradition of being a facilitator, a conduit, and a host. Basically an enabler. We try to create structures in which people can succeed in producing and delivering a message. We didn't really have any reason to try to change that position of our media center. So we really approached this from the same standpoint. All of our other stuff that we do in-house, and we have a full IT department, and we do software development and all those things. But we don't usually do those on open source. But in this case, we chose Drupal as our platform simply because we don't know where this is going to go. There may be offshoots, and that's good. I mean, we wanted this to be as organic as possible. We spent the first 9 months of building this, building it with our community. We invited the community to design the Rapidian, and they came forth and did so. Social media was absolutely invaluable to our process of getting people engaged, but it didn't stop there. There were many, many face-to-face meetings, town halls, places for people to engage. We talked to universities. We basically asked the community to continue to either reinforce what we thought we knew about the news and information needs, but also to help us design the solution. We also knew that we wanted to be part of a community-wide solution to news and media. This wasn't we were going to be the solution, or we were going to compete with traditional media, or. So we designed things in this, such as using Creative Commons licensing for the content. And our content has been picked up by commercial media and spawned other stories. And so instead of us being an aggregator of content, all our content is original, and it's aggregated by others. Because our purpose is not to say, this is ours. Our purpose is to increase the flow of news and information in our community. One of the things that we did to facilitate that is early on we had meetings with all of the news directors of the television stations. We were invited into the Grand Rapids Press to meet with all of their editors and many of their head folks, department heads, to explain this project. We said, we're not coming here to ask your permission. We're not coming here to tell you you have to do anything. But tell us, are there certain things that we can do in this project that will support you? And, you know, the ability for them to aggregate was part of it. They have been, particularly the Grand Rapids Press, has been a particularly strong supporter of this. And I'll read you a quote, but not yet. Also, we learned it's important to maintain high touch. Access centers have always been places where people come in and hold other people's hands, almost literally. We didn't want to dispense with this. The web is very, very, look at you, very, very powerful. But this is a community. We are hyper-local. We are about our community, and face-to-face is very important. So part of this project was to create neighborhood-based news bureaus in the neighborhoods, which are now being launched, where people can go and mix and mingle and talk about the things that are important to their neighborhood. And they can get access to equipment and training and support, and we're providing hardware and software and a stipend to help pay for connectivity, that kind of thing. That's all part of this plan, because that's a tradition in access that we don't think should go away. Transparency, very important. We're very upfront about what we're doing and how we're doing it and our processes. If you could go to the Rapidian really quickly.
Yep.
Go to the front page.
Yep.
Actually just go to more over here.
Yeah.
Yep. And click on that. And then there's a how to participate, I believe, if you go.
Yep.
Click on that. There's just this little graphic that shows how we found ways to engage people at multiple levels, because not everybody wants to be, just as you know, not everybody wants to come in and make the weekly talk show. That's a huge commitment in access. So we had to find various steps and ways for people to participate. And so we have the anyone, anytime. We have registered users who can comment and tag things. We also, and it goes up from there. New reporters have a required mentorship with one of our editorial mentors. Then they can go off to real-time publishing in a reporter status. There's all these levels. In addition, we collaborate with other things going on, like the GR Flickr group, which have, on their, with our blessing and support, have created a Rapidian Flickr group. So community members add photos that then reporters can use. So we try to build it into the fabric that's already there. And that was really important in having the community take ownership. The other thing, let's see, options for participation. So when we did this and we launched this, this was very exciting. This is from the Grand Rapids Press. And this is just a little piece of it. This was the main editorial for that day. The website's launch comes in the same week as the Grand Rapids Press turns 118 years old. The confluence of the long-established media meeting the new is one healthy aspect of the dawning of the information age, a multiplication of voices, an ever-widening door for debate. Where it leads, no one can tell. For now, hail to the Rapidian, intriguing experiment in citizen journalism. That would not have happened if we said we are the us and they are them. We are part of the same community. Unfortunately, I've heard at least one example this week of a paper that basically threatened a budding citizen journalism incubating thing that we're going to do everything to make sure you fail. Highly, highly unfortunate. Fortunately, they were a weekly, not very important. But I think that this sort of open, transparent thing has been really helpful to us. You know, what are we learning? High touch is always going to be valuable. The other thing that we're learning too, you know, we've got this site that's got, you know, news and opinion and all these different sections. But when we started polling people on what is it that's missing, what do you want more of, almost universally outstripping all the others combined, success stories. They want to know what's good about where they live. And you say, well, you know, but what about the hard news, that kind of thing, and the investigative journalism? That's fine, but we have created a platform that the community is self-determining, and the community is also, what I love, this to me was a signal that it's working, self-policing. We have 7 values of the Rapidian that were created by the community.
How do I get there?
If you go to About Again, and then there should be statement.
Oh, yeah, there it is. There it is, yep.
These 7 values were the values upon which everything is based, and when somebody, for instance, writes a piece and puts it in news and it's really opinion, We hear about it. It gets moved. It gets crowdsourced moved almost by the will of the community protecting these values. When someone writes a piece that is particularly one-sided, we've had perfect examples of where another community reporter would say, that's interesting, I wonder about the other side, and then goes out and reports from the other side of the story. So we are seeing the community by taking ownership of this, do this. The kind of editorial work we do is very limited. It's suggestions. First, it's fatal flaws, like your thing won't work, like it shows up gobbledygook. Most of the rest, though, is really mentoring. But we do not tell someone they can't publish something unless it totally violates policy. But the seven values, very quickly, inclusiveness, civility, that was a stated value of this project as demanded by our community. Ethical reporting, and that's really where the community starts to hold people accountable. Original works and or proper attribution. These are pretty logical and sort of like everything you learned in kindergarten kind of thing. But our community wanted these stated as our foundation. And local emphasis and cooperative distribution, which is the Creative Commons thing, and then open identity, which was what I thought would be the most controversial. There's no anonymous speech, whether it's a commenter or a reporter or anything. I am not in a position of saying one is better than the other. There are choices to be made. This is the choice that our community very clearly stated because they hated the comments they saw on the local TV station website or newspaper. Is it squelching or quieting some speech? Possibly. But we also work very hard to help people. You know, there are people who definitely will take on and report on things. They can have anonymous sources as long as the reporter themselves is not anonymous. So, you know, again, this is just what we thought we knew, the way we tried to organize it, and some of the things that we've found out to date. Is that helpful?
Absolutely.
All right, there you go.
Jim?
Yeah. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to talk today about how networks relate to the futures of news. Because I think we first need to ask the question, what is news? Joseph Pulitzer, the namesake of the prize, offers one definition and describes news as unique, curious, quaint, humorous, odd, apt to be talked about. I don't want to stress that what is apt to be talked about differs by individuals and by community, which is why I want to discuss the networks of how information and how news transfers between individuals. These networks are changing, diversifying, and there's great opportunities for community media centers and great examples of community media centers taking advantage of these networks. If we look back to the 19th century with the invention of the telegraph, the world was suddenly shrunk as the distance between communities and countries became much smaller when you could transfer news instantaneously. It was described as the first natural medium of mass communication. And of course, we have other networks such as radio, television, public access channels. And I'm sure we can all agree about the dilemmas of mainstream media becoming increasingly consolidated. For example, Comcast, a cable and internet service provider, is currently trying to purchase NBC. And another network we have throughout the world is the World Wide Web. The internet is connecting both within communities and between communities. And the internet is great because it can allow a free flow of information. However, the internet is only one of these networks, and not all communities have access to it. Only 65% of Americans have broadband at home, and in communities like the Bronx, this can be as low as 26%. And I mention these examples because news within a community is distributed across a wide array of sources. I work with the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. We're a think tank. And right now we're examining, with information community case studies directly related to the Knight Commission report on many of your chairs, how information flows in community and what are the sources. And just as a quick plug, if I want to throw out if anyone's interested in helping with one in their community, talk to myself later. But so far we have published two, led by Jessica Durkin as well as Tom Glacier, who's in the room. Two case studies on information in communities. One is Scranton, Pennsylvania, a city of 73,000, a name recognition mostly from the NBC comedy The Office. Another is Seattle, Washington, perhaps known as home of Microsoft. In both these cities, and many sources of information, such as newspapers, commercial public television, radio and internet media, such as the570.com in Scranton, or the Seattle Post-Intelliger in Seattle. But often these media can be challenged, such as the funding for WVIA in Scranton has been cut from $745,000 to just $123,000. And we are facing a continuing decline in newspapers, which have subscription rates now that are lower than they were in World War II. And following the Knight Commission report, the FCC is examining the future of media and what the information needs in communities are in a digital age. An essential component to this is for these networks within communities for communicating information. I think Barbara Popovich explained it quite well yesterday in that the ability to speak free from corporate censorship is not passé. As networks are defined to transfer information, these networks must remain as open as possible to make sure what one individual says and what they communicate is able to transfer to an audience. I think this is the role that community media centers can play in this diversifying landscape. I think community media centers are absolutely more than a channel for information. I think exemplified by Laurie and Rapidium, centers are resources that promote information production within a community. There's expanding examples of training throughout centers, and I think I've learned a lot of great examples here at this conference. And how supporting community members providing tools to use a diverse array of networks so that an individual is able to use the one that's best for reaching the audience they're trying to communicate towards. I think one interesting example is the Bay Area Video Coalition, which is working with YouTube on a project that's crowdsourcing reporting using cell phones. Members of the project with a cell phone are notified of something that could be reported on in the area. They can ping back and say, I got this one, or someone else can pick it up, go report on it, and mobily send it back to the center. Of course, all these examples and all these networks are not without challenges, both in the fundings for the centers and funding for the programs, but also the policies. To me, policy is about opportunities. A policy can enable an opportunity, or it can foreclose. For example, issues like the open internet can preserve a network, an internet that is free from corporate control, or other policies define our cell phone networks and how we're able to use those, how we access them, and who they're available to, sometimes, most often, by price of them. It can also preserve public access communities, both through funding and other policies that enable and make sure that the control over these centers remains as close to the community as possible. However, I think one fallacy on these policies is, quote, that they're decided on the national policy level. I work in Washington, D.C., and I work in a think tank, and I might describe myself as working on national policy issues, except these are local policies because they impact directly how a community is able to distribute news. Now I'd like to invite all members of this community to have a voice in these policy discussions and a voice and what the information needs of your communities are. One way to do that would be to help document the information needs of your community. Another way would be in discussions or have contacts with organizations that might be working on policies on day-to-day level in Washington, D.C. But it's important to document and discuss the challenges and successes of open networks in news in the community in order to make sure that policies that are made in Washington, D.C. are not prescriptive. They're not a person in a suit sitting in office trying to prescribe what they might think is best for the community, but they're reflective, that they are based on what is happening on the ground, what is possible on the ground, to make sure that many opportunities are open as possible, to make sure that the powers within communities to define how the information can be spread and how we can communicate. Thank you.
Great. So, centers as resources, policies as opportunities, documenting information needs, and policies that are prescriptive and reflective, and I would suggest even that might be descriptive of what's going on the ground.
Well, that's what I mean by reflective,
Policies
will reflect the realities and what is needed, the challenges, and the opportunities.
Yep.
Might I have the cord?
Yes, you might have the cord.
I really despise PowerPoint, but sometimes it's the easiest way to share some stuff. Okay. So while I'm setting this up.
You probably just need one click on your, you know, your exchange thing.
So close.
Yeah, you're getting there. There you go.
All right, well, while I'm messing around with this thing, give this one more shot.
You have to tell your computer to look for a new connection, one of the function keys.
I know.
I don't remember which one.
F7. Okay, well, it's fine. We don't really need it.
I mean, if it's on a stick, you can put it in here.
Yeah, it's not. But it's really not a big deal. It's just some visuals, which makes it a little more exciting than me just rambling. But
okay.
I will, I'll give this back to you, and maybe you can hit up some websites ramble on here. So, hey, everybody. Sorry for the slight delay. But I'm Candace Clement, and I work with Free Press. And for those of you who don't know who Free Press is, we're a national nonprofit organization that works on reforming the media and making it better. And we do that by focusing on public policy solutions for basically media that would promote the public interest as opposed to the interests of very few corporations. We do work on a lot of different stuff, a lot of stuff regarding the future of the internet, making sure everybody has access to broadband, network neutrality. If anybody doesn't know what net neutrality is, please come and talk to me, because I will gladly share the gospel with you. We do a lot of stuff on anti-consolidation work, so like the Comcast-NBC merger that James was talking about. But we also have a lot of our work focused on the future of journalism and of public media. And I think it might be helpful to take a step back and name some stuff that, you know, I think we all kind of know, but the statistics are pretty grim. In the last 2 years alone, we've lost more than 30,000 newsroom jobs at newspapers, and that impact has been especially severe on, you know, overseas bureaus, state capitals, and reporters in Washington. At this point, half of the states don't have a single newspaper covering the Congress at all. And you know, I say this about newspapers because historically newspapers have been the primary employer of journalists in our communities. They're not the only ones, but that's where a lot of the original reporting was coming from and where a lot of the investment was happening. So we're living in the state of crisis about journalism right now. And the Knight Report is particularly interesting and a great frame because it directly addresses that while at the same time addressing all kinds of information. And what the Knight Report essentially says, for folks who haven't had a lot of, you know, interaction with it at this point, is that information is as important to a healthy functioning community as clean air, safe streets, good schools, and public health. That's a pretty bold statement, I think, for something that's talking about creating policies that are like having open internet networks, making sure everybody has access to the internet, making sure that people have access to diverse sources of journalism. These are issues that people in the media reform and media justice community have been working on for years, and now they're being said by this very credible organization, these high-level people, and it's having an impact. As James mentioned, the FCC is looking at their entire media policy, like everything that they do, including things they don't even have jurisdiction over. But they're doing this major review of all of their policies, and a lot of the framework that they're using is very similar to what's in the Knight Commission report. Same thing's happening at the Federal Trade Commission around journalism. So there's all this stuff happening right now, and you know, Free Press doesn't think that there's one single solution that's going to save journalism. Would be nice, but it doesn't exist. There's all sorts of different things that we can explore, different tax codes for organizations, different funding programs for journalism jobs. But something that we have a particular interest in is the future of our public media system. And when I'm talking about public media, I'm not just talking about NPR and PBS. I'm talking about all the kinds of organizations, institutions, and individuals that are doing the kind of non-commercial public service media that the public media system is supposed to do. So it includes NPR, PBS, but it also includes low-power FM stations, public access, community media organizations. It's a pretty broad range. And at this point, we're not spending a lot of money on that. It's not a national priority. We spend $1.43 per person each year on funding public media. To give that number a little perspective, we spent about $600 per person bailing out AIG last year. So That's compared to, in other countries, European countries, they're spending upwards of $80, $100 per person. So we're really looking at what kind of policy solutions can we come up with to improve the public media system. And we have a couple different focuses. If you want to go to newpublicmedia.org, I think that's, that's one of the
I'm
reports.
I'm into your report at the moment. It's
yeah.
In the news report. But where do you want me to go?
Newpublicmedia.org. And this website has the majority of the stuff that I was going to show you guys in the presentation. So we're focused on four major areas that we think if we change them, we could have a stronger public media system in this country. The first is to increase the funding, because at this point it's pathetic. The second is our structural changes at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which include the whole process of board appointments, the way that it's set up right now. They're presidential appointments, which means that they're political appointments, and that has to do with the firewall that's protecting, you know, journalistic content. Increasing the diversity of public media in every way possible, the audience, the content, the staffing, the programming that they're doing. And then finally, expanding the definition of what public media is so that it can actually include the folks who are in this room and not just go to the same usual suspects. I can stop there. I did have some slides that I can put up on the wiki later. And this is kind of a tangential thing that I think I'll talk a little bit about tomorrow if folks are going to be at the closing thing. But back earlier this year, we did a survey of community media organizations that was really, really fascinating. I think there are probably folks in the room who took the survey, and if
is
you did, thank you.
Is it anywhere on the web? Can we find it on the web?
It's not. I don't know why. It got taken down at some point. But basically, we did this survey, and the whole point of it was to pull out sort of major themes going on in community media. So, like, what's going really well that people don't know about? What are you struggling with? What do you need? You know, just like all these different sort of things. And the response was really overwhelming, particularly from the public access community. You were the majority of respondents. You had very interesting things to say about how you even define the work that you do, whether you consider it to be television as your primary medium or web or whatever. So there's all sorts of really interesting nuggets in there. But one of the things that one of the questions that was asked was especially about news gathering and journalism. And so I just really quick can read you guys some of the responses that we got. When asked to describe their own or their organization's approach to news gathering and storytelling, the following themes were repeated. About 50% of respondents said they deployed trained citizen journalists to report news. Less than 8% of people said they relied on other news sources like NPR or PRI or Associated Press. About 25% placed their emphasis on training community members in media production in order to create their own news. And about a third said that they're relying on paid staff to do this work, some saying that they have professional journalists on staff, others saying that they do a combination of professional and volunteer. So that's an example of one of the questions that are in there. There were a lot of other ones, and there are some very interesting themes, and I really, really wanted to have a whole report like done and ready for this, but I didn't. But I will in the future, and I encourage folks, if they're interested, to get in touch with me, and I'd be happy to talk more about it. And you know, we want this information to be out there. It was not a scientific survey, but it's something that brought out some ideas and hopefully can spark other conversations and further research.
Candace, I'm going to circulate this pad, and if you want to be on Candace's mailing list, put your email on here. I'll just pass it around.
Thanks.
Yep. So let's go back to where we started for a minute, which is another wiki. Here we go. And you remember when we were getting started, I read these three bullet points from page XI of the Knight Commission report. Maximize the availability of relevant and credible information to all Americans in their communities. Strengthen the capacity of individuals to engage with information. And promote individual engagement with information and the public life of the community. What I'd like to do now is open up an edit window on this wiki. And what I'd like to do is start a conversation about how many of you represent a PEG Access operation. Okay, so we're in the right place to gather feedback from Peg Access people. So I guess my first question is, maximizing the availability of relevant and credible information to all Americans and communities. Now notice that this objective is not medium specific. It doesn't say from television or from newspapers or some from radio or from PEG Access. It just says maximize it in one way or another. Realizing that what Knight is suggesting is not medium specific, what do you think are the ways that PEG Access stations can continue to do what you already do in a more effective way in the new media environment? Yeah, in the back there.
Yeah. To get started on that, I would like Lori to tell the group the neighborhood project that she is involved in or was involved with, and the funding that you got for that and how you got it, but more or less the information that came out of that is basically addressing what you just asked.
What he's referring to is a thing called the Community Story Tree Project, and I was talking earlier about, you know, Grand Rapids sort of defining it as diverse, parallel, but rarely intersecting communities, which is what I saw coming from the San Francisco Bay Area to Michigan, to Grand Rapids specifically. I'm not trying to disparage Grand Rapids, it's lovely, but Community Story Tree, it was simply a project that attempted to deal with that using what we know how to do. It was a story collection project collecting stories through host organizations in two different neighborhoods, one largely Hispanic, one of the oldest African-American, predominantly African-American neighborhoods in Grand Rapids. We did this project where we would partner with the church or the centers of where people gather in these neighborhoods. And with their assistance and introduction and being gracious guests and not trying to storm in and say, hey, you know, tell me your story, we were able to do this project that collected 25 really authentic 5-minute video stories. We had youth who were in the neighborhoods trained to be PAs and that kind of thing, engaging them in listening to stories. And the outcome was really a number of things. One was the premiere was, while the projects took place, the collection took place parallel, but still not intersecting. The intersection came when we gathered everyone for a large screen premiere of these stories. Bringing these people together, they brought their aunts and their neighbors and their church members, and we brought these two neighborhoods together, and you know, you have a story from a mom here and a story from a mom here, and suddenly these two people have real commonality. And then it became part of the permanent archive. It's at communitystorytree.org is where the stories are currently housed for our purposes. And we use it, and it was funded by the Michigan Humanities Council, the state Michigan Humanities Council, because it was, you know, they're interested in the power of story. So I guess that's, you know, for us, that was a way not necessarily to gather the most pressing news or information, but to really empower people to celebrate the voice of the individual person and try to get them to understand that what they have to say does matter. And it's a small piece and stepping stone.
If I were to put that under one of the three rubrics, I would put it under promote individual engagement with information in the public life or the community.
I would say so, too.
Okay, so I'm going to put that down there. Thank you for encouraging Lori to talk about that. Yeah, go ahead.
I just have a comment about that.
Yeah.
You know, where I live and work, I don't know that we can create the rapidity, but what you just said is something everybody can do in every community.
That's right. Yeah.
The kind of best practice to answer those questions. That's a wonderful idea.
Well, the thing is that we
just the end result being that you're gathering the sense of the people together where they're intersecting and meeting each other.
Well, in the story tree template that is online now, where these original 25 stories are housed, is really meant, you can now sign in and get an account, that's all new. We want the community to be uploading their own stories. I mean, our intent is not to hold anything as our own, but to create systems and boxes within that are very effective for the community's use. So that has not happened yet as far as doing it, but there are new stories that are going up and new projects that realize they have a public home for their stories. So, in fact, yeah, the two front ones are new. Those were outside of the original project.
Which ones, Loretta
those,
and
the
Glenn?
Two newer yeah. ones, yes. Loretta and Glenn.
Yep.
So this, you know, we're hoping that this project really blossoms into a home for the stories of many people in our communities and will be searchable by, you know, youth or neighborhood or, and there's a mapping function too, so you can look at a map and click on a point and the story pops up.
You know, I'm a print person by background, but I have to say that when we were publishing weeklies in Massachusetts, there were three things that I could tell because I used to deliver the paper on Wednesday along with all the other things that I would do that would really make people grab the paper and comment on it. One was news about public boards and commissions and stuff. The second was investigative reporting, where we were uncovering something, where we were being a watchful eye on the community. And the third was just great written stories about neat people doing neat things. And I think, I used to think that was sort of fluff. But what I realized over the years of doing that was that it actually contributed to building the foundation of the community. A sense that we are a place where there are people who care, where there are people who have passion about what they're doing. And so I think that this Community Story Tree project is a vital part about, is a vital piece of journalism. Yeah, Colin.
One comment I wanted to add, this is really significant with this example right here. Can you scroll down to the bottom of the page?
Yeah.
And one thing you'll see at the bottom of the page is Grand Rapids Community Media Center, the logo, part of a number of other organizations' logos. This is really significant because I think in thinking about, and this is what we do in Cambridge all the time, we think about how can we bring people, the community, to our website or to our place or to our center. We need to completely change the thinking to go in this direction where are we being more effective by partnering and co-branding with our community, or is it, do we have to keep a strategy that kind of, you know, captures the community with our own portals and information? And I think that that might be an effective strategy or recommendation that I would put forward in terms of number three. Thank you, Bill.
Yeah.
That giving up ownership to our communities, not only to the residents, but to partners and community, other community groups, is a really, really important strategy moving forward that I would strongly advocate for. I think you'll find greater success, and I strongly recommend it. So it's great to see.
We use the word stewards. I mean, that we are stewards of this. We are not. We are there to amplify and put spotlight on those that we serve, not on ourselves. So, you know, it works very well, and it plays very well because it says to the people that we're working with, what we really care about are the things that matter to you. And we don't have to go out and convince them to care about us, because we're helping them achieve their message, in a sense. And it is, it's kind of, you know, at first you're like, but really, you know, it works.
Yeah, in the back there?
Well, I'm curious about your tiered membership participation.
On the Rapidian?
On the Rapidian. Is there, you say there's no, for instance, no anonymity, and they give you a name. Do you do any checking of that? Or I'm just curious what that process is.
Art and science. We actually hand authenticate every user in the sense that when they sign up to be a registered user, which is the first step of entry, we actually push the button OK on each one of those. Now, it's funny. There's a lot that, you know, absolutely that's not a real person, you know, Bugs Bunny. And if we have one that we're questioned about, we just send a nice, friendly, personal email back saying, we're having a tough time authenticating your something, something, something. And can somebody get around it? Yeah. Are we here to be the police? No.
I was just curious if there was any mechanism.
Yeah, no, our mechanism is high touch, basically. Uh-huh. And that is our mechanism at this point. And when somebody has started to do some really, you know, we've had people who said, you know, this person isn't a real person. You know, it's very self-policing. But we do take that step to hand authenticate every user. And we have over 1,000 authenticated users. We have 150 regular reporters, 80 nonprofits, and about a dozen editorial mentors.
Okay.
I'd like to point out, I've been in every Citizen Journal workshop since pre-conference, and the word high touch has come up. The words high touch have come up just as the theme, you know, in terms of the...
Where would you put that under the three objectives of the Knight Commission suggests, that notion of high touch?
Three.
I mean, it just seems that of course, there's no way to do it without that, is what it seems to be. Like, you know, if you take your hands off for a second, the thing kind of just loses it, just entropy.
But we have a lot that's automated, and the structure itself is meant to be not too complicated, difficult. People can do a lot of things themselves. But the high touch part for us is its relationship. It's local. It's identified with the geographic place. And increasing, we have lots of tweet ups and meetups and all that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Gretchen from Philadelphia Community Access Media, and we're a news station and wanting to kind of adopt best practices. And I think one thing that would help me is if there's kind of already tested kind of curriculum or sort of trainings or just kind of manuals that we could use in beginning to train our own. Members and constituents becoming journalists.
There's a bunch of stuff.
So Alliance for alliancecm.org/resources.
Is that there already?
Wait a minute. Read that to me again.
alliancecm.org/resources. No, that's not it.
Feels so strange to find it.
Hold on, 1 second. This keeps coming up. This has come up all week, too. Everybody would love to have resources that they can use to adapt their projects back in their communities. It's www.alliancecm.org/resources. When I put this out to other folks in Access, this came back as, this is what everyone was asking about last year. So we created this great page. We need your help to contribute to this. And when I say we, I guess I'm talking for the Alliance for Community Media, so that we can make this a really great resource for all of you. There's one thing that I would ask, so hopefully this is a good place where you could start to find some of these resources. One other thing, I would take it a step further, though. I was talking with some other folks about this, how to make it even better than it already is. If you find something that's useful and you've adapted it to your own community, please consider sharing it back on the site, so that other communities can benefit from what you've learned from it. And then I think you can create this really incredible, rich resource for all of us.
I'd also encourage people to go to the Knight Citizen News Network's learning modules section. On the Rapidian, if you go to the About section, there's a place that says Resources for Citizen Journalism. We have all the links to that, along with other tutorials that we have found and basically collected together. But there is a direct link to the learning modules page from Knight Citizen News Network, and it's really good stuff.
Yep, it's coming up.
The link to the Citizen News, it's at the bottom.
Where is that?
Near the bottom. There you go, learning modules page, under tutorials.
Okay.
Right there.
Okay, I'm going to pick that up and include it in the wiki we're working on. Okay, so back to our goal for the session. How do you think you can maximize the availability of relevant and credible information to all Americans in their communities? If let's start, if you want, by just shouting out the ways you do that now. How do you do that right now?
Well, you mentioned that the one thing that we in PEG Access do is we teach. We're trainers. We're educators. We need to make sure that we kind of evolve and learn how to tell. It's digital storytelling that's the key issue here, and that we don't make TV anymore. We don't teach people to make TV. We teach them to tell digital stories, and that will certainly help to maximize the availability of.
Well, so just using our own on air to promote that we do these things, just to tell the community that we're engaged in on air.
So what we're pulling out of this workshop seems like we need to really focus on teaching journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just how to use Canvas and how to use, I mean, it's really, let's start a curriculum of journalism.
And I think that links up really well to what Colin and Lori were talking about earlier as far as bringing other NGOs into mm-hmm. the work that you're doing. Like, there's mm-hmm. lots of organizations within communities that do this kind of work and are often operating in silos. I mean, this is even the case where I live. We have a low-power FM community radio station that's a couple years old, and we have a relatively new public access station, and there's very little communication between the two. Mm-hmm. And it can be challenging because they're often volunteer-run, but making that commitment to working together, and I think having one project that you can come together around really helps with that. So it could be something like creating that resource.
Yeah.
We found out from Nevada County in California, we found we did some survey where that our, what we call community correspondents, are a little intimidated if it's just like a general catch basket called news. But when we talk to them and created social media networks around community of interest, so it was like arts or food and wine or recreation and whatever, that they learned to communicate with each other. And as a correspondent within the community, they were not intimidated at all because they
yeah.
were, you know, responding to friends. And we then recruited in nonprofits and even government agencies to be part of that network. So it would be the Nevada County Youth Network, the one we got up.
That strikes me as fitting under the goal of strengthening the capacity of individuals to engage with information. Can you frame that as a goal statement? In other words,
well,
what's your...
To organize, I guess, to organize networks in a way that are...
Organize local networks?
Yeah, local yeah. networks.
Yep.
In a way that mirrors the interests of the community, you know, community's interest. So that people don't want to be, we found that a lot of folks are intimidated by being a journalist to a newspaper, but they're not intimidated by being a correspondent within a community of interest.
I'm sorry. Just
yeah.
to say that another way, one of the other things that is also my takeaway for the week, and some of you have probably heard me say this already, is it's so key that we move to talk about the work that we do in terms of the needs that we serve rather than the tools that we use to serve those needs. And I think that sort of what you're saying,
yeah.
in this case, if it's food, if it's information about food or entertainment or whatever that people are looking for, we can be useful to them providing that information, rather than if we're TV people or internet people or mobile devices or journalists or news people, you know, let's talk about what the end result is that we're facilitating rather than the tools that we use. I think that's been helpful for me, and I don't know if others find that useful.
Yeah, that's exactly
what
I was actually, what I was just looking for was a citation to a colleague, Len Witt, at Kennesaw State University, because he uses the term community weaver to describe a little bit what you're talking about. In fact, I think he might even have gotten that from Jay Rosen. But I think that might be the less intimidating term that you're thinking of that might help, is to say, is because a community weaver weaves and intermixes connections in a way that creates a tapestry, a fabric that's a whole. So the whole intention of a community weaver is to make something, to take pieces and make them whole. Yeah. Yes.
I would say, I think Bob Devine previously would have called that convening authority.
Convening authority, yeah.
Starting conversations and being the place where people come to talk about those.
Okay, so I'm going to add community. Oops.
Convener.
Yeah. The community conveners or weavers. Okay. All right. More hands, yeah.
I think I have a good example of a local network.
Mm-hmm.
In West Hartford, Connecticut, we now go directly into the schools.
Mm-hmm.
We're there every week. The best way to describe what we're doing is probably video clubs. And
video clubs?
Video clubs, after school.
Is there a place on the web that we can look at that?
Sure.
What? Tell me where to go.
WHCTV peg.com. And what happened is, what started out to be student videos, when you talk about folks being intimidated, mm-hmm. we went from students to teachers. Now teachers are stepping up and saying, hey, can I do a video?
That's interesting.
Oh, goodness. Oh.
Is it WH?
You know, it's West Hartford Community Television.com. Sorry, that does pop up sometimes.
West Hartford
Community Television.com.
Wow. Ooh.
There is.
Hey, it could be worse. What am I doing wrong?
Just try Googling it.
Yeah, it was
oh, that's a good idea.
Sorry. But we've just seen this thing evolve, and it's just been so interesting that it's actually the students that have set the example, and now you've got the teachers saying...
Oh, org.
Dot org, sorry. Yeah. So sorry. And now you've got the teachers saying, hey, what about me? And in this community where education is so important, we now have, under Be the Media, if you scroll down on the left, Be the Media videos, mm-hmm. and it's by school. Some of the schools have taken off with it. Others,
oh, wow.
Other schools are just starting to get it. But we have a monthly broadcast, so everybody starts seeing what the other schools are doing, and it's just really taken off.
So this is all text or video? Oh, it's all video. Oh my gosh, that's
funky
amazing.
Shooting.
You know, I can show you. Well, this is a really good example here. If you can.
What, Odyssey of the Mind?
Yes.
Okay.
This is a Quest program, gifted students. What I do is I go in and I tell them how to tell their story. But this is a good example of kids who are highlighting their work. Oh no, I'm sorry. Sorry.
No, that's not it.
That's not it. It's History Day.
History Day.
it's the same type of program.
Okay.
Quest. Yeah, in Quest of Historic Innovations.
That one. Oh, I hit the wrong button. Sorry.
Are they doing this after school or is it part of the school day?
No, it's after school. And all of the videos do go through the main office. I mean, they're letting me wander with kids and shoot whatever we want, but they want to see the end result before it goes on our website.
The most memorable adventures in Quest of Students History Day in all of thought. We traveled to Torrington and Harvard to show our discoveries of stunning innovations. KP is doing town in first place for his paper on bayonets.
So they have this video from the award ceremony that we worked on. And you know, you actually hear the teacher saying, James! You know, which is like the true emotion of it all.
So all of this is shot. Who shot this video?
I shot the start.
Yeah.
But most of it incorporates the kids' work. Like now they're going to go to a student who produced a documentary.
Yeah.
And we show a little bit of that. I can give you another. I can show you something on the high school level that's really good.
Okay. Where do I go?
If you go to the list of schools, Paul High School, go back to the list of schools.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oops. Getting there. There we go. Which high school?
Paul High School.
Third one down from the top.
Okay.
And you should see PTO.
Paul PTO?
Yep, that's it.
Does anybody else have this much video out of their schools? Put your hand up. Wow, that's a... from a non-video place, I'm just amazed that you got this stuff on here.
We got a small grant from the Census Bureau where they were trying to get people to participate in the census.
Uh-huh.
So we did a project where we went into schools and had students produce public service announcements.
Forms was made possible by Paul's PTO.
Wait a minute.
Wow.
The PTO?
This is my freshman
year. The students even know what the Hall PTO is and what it does for the Hall community. I'm going to go find out.
Can most everybody hear this?
I have no idea.
PTO doesn't really mean much to me as of now because it's like there's no communication between the PTO and the students, so most students don't even know what it is.
I don't know if they do.
I showed my interviews with former PTO president, Mrs. Vanya.
Video froze.
She wasn't surprised that students are...
So basically, he took the comments from the kids to the PTO president.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was just talk about letting students' voices be heard.
Yeah.
And she said, hey, I don't care that they don't know what it is as long as their parents do.
I hope they got that on tape.
But do you think she really thought that in her own head?
Well, that's what she said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what she had to say.
That's what he put up.
Well, to me, that's journalism.
Right. Yeah.
Because something is going to change because of that video.
It has, if you look, you can see how many hits it got, too. It's
oh, where is that listed?
It's listed right next to the slug.
Back on
the previous
page.
I mean, what I have found is I went...
Oh, yeah, it's the largest, the next highest, Open Volleyball, of course. Yeah, but that's pretty good.
And I went in wanting to teach students storytelling.
Yeah.
And quickly found out it is managing the editorial process. I mean, I had two juniors come to me who wanted to do school spirit, and I quickly realized they wanted to do it because they thought school spirit stunk. You know, it was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So they learned in the process, if you know, you talk to people beyond your clique, it was actually ended up to be a pretty balanced report.
So I just heard you say that you did editing. Do you feel as if that's uncharted territory for a PEG Access person, that you're making editorial judgments or helping the kids make them?
Was it editing or was it encouragement?
Yeah.
What I said out loud to these girls, said, you know, this isn't just about what you think. You have to go and interview a lot of people. So I guided them. They did that. They talked to dozens of kids. Mm-hmm. And ended up realizing there are a lot of mixed feelings about
you know what's
there.
Interesting? Though, that is what the old green eyeshades city editor would have said to the cub reporter 30 years ago in a commercial newsroom.
Yeah, I worked in a commercial newsroom.
So you understand that.
In a television newsroom.
So I guess the reason...
And the issues that I dealt with
right.
with professional reporters are the exact same issues I deal with kids.
So the reason that why I'm pushing on this is because... In my experience working with PEG Access people as a journalist over the years, I've sensed this real reluctance to step over some line into a place where you are doing anything other than saying, here's the equipment, there's the time, here are the mechanics of how you edit. It's all yours. I now step back. But you haven't done that. You're not doing that.
I'm guiding, but I'm constantly saying to these
right.
kids, it's your report.
And I would make the argument that you all have to start doing that. And you're going to run into ethical and political issues with your funding authorities, but you've got to go there because nobody else is doing it anymore. I mean,
but it also falls under teaching journalism.
Yes, it does.
Ethics.
Yes, it does.
Teaching storytelling the right way.
And the history of being passive, and I'm going to say something that's probably going to piss off half the people in the room. It's lazy. It really is lazy. Our job is not to push buttons. Our job is to support the voice, and we heard that from the stage, and we need to be teaching people. I'm not saying, yes, I'll play your show, no, I won't play yours. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about creating opportunities for success in people achieving what they're trying to achieve. You must do more than simply teach people to push buttons. Sometimes it means reduce a barrier to entry. Sometimes it means create a project in which they participate in the creation of a mosaic. It's a lot of things, and many, many structures should occur. But to just say, we are passive, we don't do anything but hand out equipment, is, in my opinion, a dereliction of duty when it comes to PEG Access.
Can I just jump off of that real quick? Because there's a similar thing here when we've found in talking to traditional journalists about their own livelihood and their industry and what's happening, there's this distanced, well, we don't want to get involved and advocate for anything. Well, your boss is definitely doing that, and that's why everyone's getting fired. So I would say that along the same lines, like the kinds of, at the policy level, the kinds of things that will enable PEG to continue, mm-hmm. community media to continue, journalism to continue to be funded. You have to be engaged in those conversations as well.
I don't know how you all feel about Michael Moore, but he made a very interesting comment in an interview. He was interviewed for an hour by Democracy Now! About a week ago, and he said essentially this is paraphrasing. He said, "Look, I don't understand why people think it is a bad thing to be called an activist." He said, "If you aren't an activist, then you aren't engaged in a democracy. If we all cease being activists, then we have a democracy only in name." And I think that's partly what underlies my perception of there is nothing wrong with activism if activism is tempered by judgment and fairness and respect for diverse points of view. Yeah.
I have a question. I totally agree that keeping a hands-off approach is lazy, and I've seen a lot of poor programming on our channel as well as other access channels simply because it's a matter of we don't want to influence aesthetics or what have you. And I would just like to ask anybody who has any input on, well, how can we navigate that political situation of influence? How can we improve content? How can we foster citizen journalism how can we do that?
We're not talking about censorship. We're talking about
facilitating. We're not talking about censorship, but there is somewhat of a line.
What if there's a lot of hands, so I'll just make a very quick comment. What if ACM were to develop a set of guidelines for appropriate sort of, I don't know what the right word is, for appropriate teaching of ethics and judgment and principles of creating media? Sorry, question?
Well,
there are lots of questions.
What it boils down to is just that. I don't think she's editing.
Yeah.
Right. I think she's teaching, go out and get the other side of the story.
It really
right.
goes back
right.
to
that's
upholding
not,
the standards that you talked about
right.
on your website.
Yeah.
I'm not
yeah.
going to let the kids do a negative report when it's obvious if they talk to enough students they're going to find varying points of view on school spirit. So
it sounds like
censorship, that's just open your minds, talk to enough people so you get a fair report, which is what we were after.
But those seven values are for the Rapidian. Now, our access channel, I'm not going to say to somebody, oh, you can't do that, you have to be civil, because some people aren't. But our job is to really help that person be as effective as possible. All I'm saying is you have to do more than teach.
It's subtle,
the
though, but couldn't you say, you know, you might not want to do that.
Oh, absolutely. I have no trouble
can't.
Saying that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The if you're trying to be effective, this is likely to work better
exactly.
than that.
Yeah.
From the baseline, that's the difference between an editorial and news. I mean,
in sense, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then from a public access perspective, you could build it into whatever workshops and
yeah.
programs that you offer.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the encouragement and incentives built into that, and it would be entirely opt-in. You know, so rather than try to exercise editorial, not control, but comments on what someone's currently working on, you can develop your programs and resources that you provide with this in mind. And so that people can opt into this and want to become a part of this process and a part of this collective project.
If I can offer one more
yeah.
example, one of the reports at Hall High was on their new monitoring system. They spelled out announcements rather than delivering them over the PA system. Two students went out and did a report, and they brought back sound from students that were critical. I told them, go back and try to get the other side. They came back and said, we couldn't find it. The students hate it, and we could not. So what I did was I suggested, well, I happen to know that their principal's sound, his interview, was positive. Of course, he loves it. So that's how we balanced it. But I, at some point, had to believe these kids. It's their report. They went out. I wasn't with them in the halls. That now everybody we talk to hates it. So we had negative student comment, the principal giving the benefits of the monitoring system. And the principal approved the piece. I mean, he questioned me, and I said, the kids said they couldn't find a positive response. I sent them back out. So, yes, there's a discussion, there's guidance, but I don't think those kids were censored.
With our general public access training, we don't tell them anything about what their content should be, but we do try to encourage excellence in terms of camera work and mm-hmm. so on, technical. But when we're dealing with schools and organizations, we just see that as a little different. And usually when you go into a school, almost every school, it's the same experience, you start talking to them about doing a project. And they kind of come up with things that are really, maybe just for a couple of their friends. So you have to get them to think of something that's mm-hmm. going to reach a broader audience. That mm-hmm.
same principle.
Right. So
right.
you have to handle it
differently. Yeah. Other comments? Yeah.
Going back to something slightly different, I'm maximizing availability from the other workshops I've been in this week.
Yep.
We were really amazed early on how little video was coming over to, you know, being utilized. I think we said like 20% was thrown around as a
possible. Yeah, I remember that number.
And I think your question to us as PEG is that I think we already have a lot of video that we're not thinking of sending over and being part of that build out of your community news. And I think we're still thinking in different silos here, and some of us are seeing the merging of those. But currently, I think that you can create ingest video and put it up on cable. So whether it's being put on your put together for your web page or your citizen journalism paper, if you want to call it that, it can still come over and be up on your content mm-hmm. on your page. So, I mean, it's a double, and you're also covering, which has come up before too, the fear some people have of funding, saying you're all supposed to be on cable, you're now doing that. I think Pamela Cambridge is doing that, isn't it, that your stories are on both, aren't they?
Yeah, we're trying to do that.
Quick question. How many people would be willing to put teasers for some of your stuff on YouTube? Raise your hands.
We do. A lot of us do.
Okay, good. Okay. Is there anybody who doesn't like that idea, and if so, why? Okay.
Why? Can I ask why just teasers instead of the...
Well, because you've got a 10-minute time limit, right?
We use archive.org, and we embed things like crazy, because there's no limit. It's not commercial.
Yep. So that's an option for getting around the limit. Yeah. Yes?
I just want to tell you what we're doing, where to see where it fits in. We collaborate a lot with the local newspaper, which is weekly.
Great.
It's struggling.
Where is this that you're located?
In Belmont, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And
Belmont Citizen.
Citizen Herald. Yeah. And they're looking for any way. Nobody in the town wants to see the newspaper go down. So we do a lot of focused partnerships on debates and discussions, and it seems to help both organizations. But I'm always thinking, do we really want to be doing this? I mean, the newspaper is a commercial enterprise, but it is seen as a new source.
Small business. I mean. Your community is your community, and you know.
No, I know that, and people. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but it you know, you think about what you're doing, which is nonprofit. It's not a commercial venture in that way. And the newspaper editor will be looking for things. How can I get people to get to my? What do I have to put in the headline? Mm-hmm. You know, so he's not always thinking about what do people want to hear about, but what's going to be the headline.
Well, there's benefit from our side too, though, because you know, we have to have full attribution, and there's always, whenever anything's on there, the paper's web, there's a link back to the Rapidian, and we've had no trouble getting that kind of...
But I guess my question is, am I partnering with the old way of doing news? I mean, is this something... I mean, it seems to be valuable to the community. They want to see more of it. We're getting more interest in what we're doing as a result of the collaboration, so... But you see the newspaper and the subscriptions are going down and down and down.
Well, there's no doubt that you're helping a commercial enterprise. But I think you have to look at the larger picture and how are you helping the community of Belmont by doing that. And since you're mission focused, then if the answer is you're helping to contribute to the information ecosystem of Belmont by working with some commercial entity, and your mission is to improve the information ecosystem for citizens of Belmont, to me that's a no-brainer.
Yeah, it might not
be a no-brainer for them. That's up to them to decide. Yeah.
And then patch.com is kind of the next.
Yeah, do you collaborate with patch.com? That's an interesting one. Yeah.
Which is now coming to my community, and I have to.
Where is that?
Concord, Mass.
Okay.
And they're in a half a dozen towns in New England now.
Can you give me a URL to the Patch site?
Just go patch.com.
Yeah.
And there's a list
That's AOL, right?
Yeah, AOL is funding that. And their whole, that's the states they're charging.
Okay, there you go. So they're in Belmont, too.
Yeah.
You said Concord?
Yep.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they're template, so everything looks the same on everybody's site. They have a little video on the side of the editor. Their model is to share reporters across three or four towns.
Yep.
All look alike.
Yeah.
And
they come to our center saying we want to learn how to do video so we can put video on our site.
Maybe there's not, but it's like, okay, wait a minute, there's got to be some different way to
I fit this in with my nonprofit point of view?
Yeah, well, I guess I think if you're asking me, I'd have to repeat what I just said a minute ago.
Okay.
Even though it's a little bit more of a hold your nose situation dealing with a really large company. I wonder how long this is going to be around.
Well, that's the other part of this.
So I would say don't get dependent on them for anything.
I kind of look at them as like the training wheels that eventually I may be able to take over that. I don't know.
And you know your community
should be working with you. We've got 5 more minutes and lots more hands, so we'll pick up the pace just a little bit. Yeah, in the back there.
So this goes back to something somebody mentioned a while ago. They said that some news organizations and politicians don't like, they're not going to like us because we started a news program 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Where is this?
Methuen, Mass.
Okay.
Yeah. It's very hyper-local. We only cover Methuen news. Mm-hmm. Our pitch is we only cover good news.
Mm-hmm.
We started it during the time when there was a lot of bad things going on, and that was all you heard. So we went to the complete opposite end of the spectrum. Admittedly, some people say, well, you're not covering everything.
Is that site online somewhere?
Yep, methuentv.org. It's M-E-T-H-U-E-N. But we've created such a wonderful relationship with our politicians now because they like the fact that we're covering the things that they're not hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So they come to us and say, gee, would you like to give us another thought? The name of the show is Methuen Now. It would be listed under videos on the left-hand side. And then we put individual little clips up just to tell you a little bit about the different stories. But we've been getting great feedback from it.
Neat. Okay, so this gives you an example of some of the stories you're running.
We pick like 2 or 3 from each show and put them on.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The primary paper there is the Lowell paper, right?
No, actually Lawrence.
Lawrence, okay.
Eagle Tribune.
Yeah, okay. Well, quickly, any more? Yeah.
Just a quick example for people that during this transition, we get approached in Amherst, Mass. Quite a bit for training journalists.
Mm-hmm.
That are being asked to become backpack journalists and they don't know the first thing about video, which is interesting that we become a trainer to go up to know that news is going to be posted somewhere else. But the local one of the local papers, two of them, one, the Hampshire Gazette, which also runs the local, the Amherst Journal, called and there was an override they wanted covered. They were going to sponsor it. What we covered, we'd already covered everything up to that point for free for everybody. And we said, we bartered. I said, sure, give me X amount of dollars worth of free advertising when I need to come in and post something, okay? So, I mean, it was like a first-time business relationship that they took it. The second one is Mass Live. It's the Springfield Republicans Online. And they're looking for, they just wrote me last week asking for any video. And with our tags, whatever we want to put on it.
Colin, quickly.
So, really quickly, one thing I just realized that spans all three categories that might be a useful approach for the future and thinking about the work that we do, and it's been proposed in other areas, particularly public media folks have proposed, is to become a curator of local content to help people find relevant information that they're looking for, or collaborating with partners who are also doing that work, so we could essentially move people from both receiving information but also becoming participants. And help them with, that leads to media literacy and other types of training. But I think that's a huge role that we can play in our communities that I think really touches on all three areas that might be useful.
Anybody else?
I can
Yes. We've collaborated well with the weekly newspapers, this is on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, with the weekly newspapers and supplying them video with attribution, and we cross-pollinated on a video that we use on the public access channel with our citizen journalist page, and we're working well, and it's going to work well as long as we don't step over and start selling advertising. Now, I realize that the sustainability platform of most people, advertising doesn't come into play there, but it's something that we may have to do. And I think as soon as we start competing, we're going to lose a lot of collaboration strength that we have with
Likely so, yeah.
I was just going to mention an organization, a nonprofit in Philadelphia called the Media Mobilizing Project, and their website's mediamobilizing.org. And I think the work that they're doing would never end up on a public broadcasting station because it's activist-based and it has a point of view. And I think that their work, they work directly with on various campaigns and working with activists that are doing that work. And yet, it's very journalistic, but it's definitely... has a point of view, and I think that that's something that I see as being really important in what PEG is able, public access is able to do, is to kind of have that work shown and not having to worry about it being so kind of objective and not necessarily.
Well, so what's the key value of that over any other website, are you saying?
I'm not saying that it has a key value. I'm just saying the fact that I, as a public access station in Philadelphia, can show this, but WHYY, which is our public access station, which is our public broadcasting station, has made it very clear that they won't show this.
Oh, because it has a point of view.
Yes.
I want to push back. It's just, as you talk about news and talk about journalism, it's, I think it can be difficult to see what does have a point of view and what doesn't. I think one thing that MMP is a great example in Philadelphia, but there's a recent report on journalism in Philadelphia that left out not only MMP, but also left out a large majority of ethnic press, and I think it's challenging to, I think at times when we talk about news, to present what often is a white perspective as an objective perspective, because it's what we consider normative, and I think it's important to include diversity. And it might not be, I think it can be viewed as activism, but I think it can also, MMP can be viewed as journalism, because it's getting stories out there, and these stories will make a difference, and as journalism can affect policies. So I think it's important to have avenues for these.
Literally the person at HYY told me that they would do the job. So
yeah.
To me, that's
which is
where
interesting.
That's where I see, public access is having its own kind of niche or something that's specific to what we bring to the table.
Yes, in the way back.
Yeah, some of the most vocal critics of mainstream media for the past year has been the Tea Party movement. Has anyone been able to capture that energy in community media? Neighborhood news.
In actually, in Concord, we've had the Tea Party members bring in programming from their points of view of issues that I would consider from the other side of the aisle. But we broadcast it. Yeah. We play it. Whatever people bring in, we're the soapbox.
Yep.
So, I talk to these people, and they're very happy with public access. They love public access because they know in a basically liberal community, the conservative point of view gets presented.
Yep.
And not in a 30-second sound.
Yep. Anybody have any last contributions to these three core vision issues before we finish that up and wrap up our session?
Yep. Where is this going to be posted?
Well, it'll be posted temporarily right where it is now, but I'm sure Colin and I will move it eventually over to the aggregation site.
Okay.
So right now you'll find this all at...
Actually, can you point out the PEG, our channels site? That's where it's going to end up.
It's going to end up here. That's a long URL. I did create, before I came downstairs, a tiny URL for the page we've been working on. And if you remember that, we will definitely put a link at that location to wherever its permanent location is going to be. And that tiny URL was tinyurl.com/ACMCityJ. Here it is right here. tinyurl.com/ACMCityJ will go to the page that we're looking at right now. And we'll change that. We'll give you a redirect that'll take you to wherever the ultimate location is.
When you have our email,
yeah, we'll send you an email with information about it too. Yeah, one last thing I wanted to make sure you all knew about is this event coming up September 23rd and 24th in Chicago. It's put on by the Knight Foundation, the Reynolds Journalism Institute, where I am associated, the Chicago Community Trust, and Loyola University. It's a gathering of local online news community folks from around the country to share best practices. It's invitation only, but I think we would really like to have a couple of folks from the PEG Access community who are thinking about community journalism to come and both share what you've learned and pick up ideas. So if anybody's interested in coming to this, email me and I'll get you an invitation. You can email me at densmore@mediagiraffe.org. That's probably the easiest email address to remember. densmore@mediagiraffe.org. Anything else? Anybody else want to shout out anything before we adjourn?
I would just love to meet all the Massachusetts PEG people here because I'm also from Massachusetts. So. And apparently most of the room is too.
Massachusetts.
All right.
Nice. Pack the house.
We're everywhere.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
I was actually wondering what you're thinking about what was just raised, which was like, you know, how do you channel?